I'm just seeing this like West Side Story of like the rivalry between magnetic fusion and laser fusion.
The Sharks and the Jets?
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
I'm Nick Ebling, founder and CEO of Not Impossible Labs. For the past 15 years, we've been on a mission to change the world through technology and story by addressing societal problems to improve the lives of everyone. With a crew of engineers, hackers, entrepreneurs, technologists, storytellers, and artists, we've tackled and solved some of the world's most incredible challenges. But here's the thing. We're just a small team in Venice Beach. The world is full of people making the impossible possible. My goal now with this podcast is to find these people, share their stories, and hopefully, together, we can keep pushing the limits of what's possible. On today's episode, we talked to Dr. Kimberly Budil, who recently oversaw the first ever net positive nuclear fusion energy reaction.
The facility is the size of 3 football fields, and it's 10 stories tall at its greatest extent. Laser beams, 92 come in from the top, 92 come from the bottom. We put enough terawatts to be significantly more than the entire generating capacity of the entire U.S. grid.
Dr. Kim Budil, thank you for joining us. A quick intro on Dr. Kim. Dr. Budil is the 13th director of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. She was appointed in 2021. First woman to hold this position since the lab was founded in 1952. Let's give a woo-woo on that. That's awesome. Congratulations on that. That's amazing. She first worked at Lawrence Livermore in 1987 as a scientist, and then again in 1994 as a postdoctorate fellow. Prior to becoming the director, the principal associate director of weapons and complex integrations at Lawrence Livermore from 2019 to 2021. Before that, she was the VP for the National Lab at the University of California. Did you go to Cal? Did you go to Berkeley?
I went to UC Davis.
Davis. All right. So you're a UCer. I love it. We need to cite you for a violation. You are, seems to me like you're violating the fundamental laws of physics. That's in all of our research. There seems to be some shenanigans happening over there on the side of your team and Lawrence Livermore. Can you explain to me a little bit about what is going on over there?
So you must be talking about our research in fusion.
That is it. That is exactly what we're talking about.
Exactly. And I realize that most people think of fusion as something in the realm of science fiction, not science fact.
Right.
But this is a very well understood, actually, physical process that we've been thinking about for a very long time. And if you go outside on an average day and you look up in the sky, you'll see a giant fusion reactor shining down on you. So fusion is the process that powers the sun. It's the process by which two heavy isotopes of hydrogen, so hydrogen atoms that have an extra neutron added to them, or two extra neutrons added to them, fuse together, creating a heavier nucleus and releasing energy. And we've been working for the last 60 years to try to harness that process in the laboratory and see if we can achieve those conditions by a different method in our labs here. So in recent years, after, as I said, 60 years, we finally have cracked the code at some level on how to really harness these reactions and begin toward making fusion energy in particular science fact rather than science fiction.
There was a moment. That moment was December 5th, 2022. I believe it was a little after 1 a.m, where all of a sudden an email, an auto text.
Text.
A weather balloon as a text came through to the team and said, "We did it, Eureka." Let's talk about what happened there. And I want you to, if you could, correct me if I'm wrong as I go through this, right? Nuclear fusion is you are taking two atoms and colliding them together with so much force that they fuse together into a single atom. I've got it so far? Okay. And then that resulting atom, and this is the part where I think you're violating physics, and we really need to, if we're gonna arrest you, we really need to get to the bottom of this here. But that resulting atom is lighter than the combined mass of those two atoms. And then the loss, now where you're like, wait a second, you're breaking the rules here, that loss is actually what's converted into energy. And that's the aha moment in this.
That's right.
How did I do?
You did really well. You did really well. Remember, E equals MC squared. Energy is mass times the speed of light squared. So what really happens when you push these two atoms together, you create a helium nucleus and a neutron flies away carrying a bunch of energy. And so it's that neutron that's going to carry the energy off that we're going to capture and measure to understand how the reaction is proceeding. So you got it just right. Well done.
Good. I have an amazing team that make me feel stupid and make me not sound stupid. So that's perfect. So talk about the number of lasers, talk about the optics, talk about everything that happens and what those lasers are focusing on and the size of this little peppercorn that you're putting in that little capsule. I'm already kind of telling you where, you know, talk about that because that is truly fantastic.
Yes. So just for perspective, when the researcher here, John Nuckles, first proposed that lasers could be used to do fusion in the early 60s, it was right when the laser had been invented. So this is long before laser pointers and barcode scanners and anything. So no one knew these things could even be useful. So for me, from the beginning, it's the most amazing idea in the world because it's so far over the horizon. He thought it would take 1,000 joules of laser energy to make fusion reactions in the laboratory. So here's where we are today. Today, we're home to the National Ignition Facility, which is the world's largest, most energetic laser.
Dr. Kim is referring to the National Ignition Facility, commonly known as NIF. To get a sense of its immense scale, this impressive structure covers a footprint equivalent to 3 football fields and rises 10 stories high.
Inside that facility, we have 192 laser beams. So each of those laser beams is going to carry enough power to begin to rival the generating capacity of the U.S. electrical grid. So this is a very powerful machine. So we start with one pulse, one very small pulse of energy, and we begin to amplify it up. So we start with about 1/1,000,000,000th of a joule.
Okay.
And we begin to add energy to it through this laser amplification process. So the way that works is we have slabs of glass that are doped with a particular element called neodymium.
Neodymium. And what is neodymium?
It is an element that has a particular energetic transition that allows you to store energy in the atom and then take that energy out very quickly when you send a light pulse through.
Okay.
So we use flash lamps, which are just like big flash bulbs, to pump energy into all those neodymium atoms, get them all excited. And then we send our little pulse of laser light through that, and it extracts that energy very rapidly. And now the pulse is a little bigger. And then we go through this process again, and the pulse is a little bigger.
And that every time it does, that magnet, similar to when we're taking that big fusion ball in the sky and taking our magnifying glass to burn a hole in paper, is that a similar thing that's happening right now? Is it you taking and that's the amplifying the energy or the intensity of the laser?
Yeah, sort of. We're taking all this energy that's sort of spread out in this piece of glass and these atoms and coalescing it in this little pulse.
Okay.
And the secret here is what we call achieving high energy density. So we have a lot of energy in a very short amount of time. So those 192 laser beams all go to our target chamber area, and they split into two groups. 96 go up, 96 go down, and they're all steered into a big spherical target chamber that's about 30 feet in diameter. The laser pulses are in the infrared frequency range, so the invisible red light end of the spectrum, when they come to the laser target chamber wall. And we convert that light using big crystals to ultraviolet light, so very short wavelength light. So at the end of that process, we have about 2 million joules of laser energy in this blue light. All that energy gets focused down into a little cylinder, and I have a prop.
Oh, I'm so glad you have it. You do? Yes!
So this is a little bit bigger than an actual target, but it's illustrative. So it's about a centimeter long, and it has holes on the top and the bottom. The laser beams.
It looks like a tiny spool of thread, basically.
It does, exactly. Laser beams, 92 come in from the top, 92 come from in the bottom. And they hit this can on the inside. This can is made out of gold. And the gold converts all that laser energy to X-rays. So the trick there is we take all of this light that's in sort of discrete points, and we make a very uniform X-ray oven. So the can is very hot, full of these hot X-rays. And in the center of the can is a little capsule, just as you described, about the size of a peppercorn, made out of diamond, in this case.
So it's a little hollow. Peppercorn's made out of diamond.
It's made out of diamond. So it's a gold hole room with a diamond capsule. In the little diamond sphere, which is hollow, we have put our hydrogen fuel. So it's deuterium, which has one extra neutron, or two extra neutrons. Tritium has an additional extra neutron. We put that deuterium and tritium fuel in the little capsule, and we cool it down to very cold temperatures so that we have just the right precise conditions to begin compressing that little ball of fuel up.
Okay.
So now I have my little ball of fuel sitting in a hot X-ray oven. The X-rays heat up the outer surface of the diamond and blow it off. It begins to, like, just like the rocket effect. The outer surface blows off. That pushes the inner surface in. And the trick is to make the inner surface move in very fast and squeeze up that deuterium and tritium to very high temperature and density, and then hold it together long enough so that the fusion reactions can become self-sustaining. So each time two atoms fuse and release a little bit of energy, if the fuel is very, very dense, that neutron will get trapped and it'll make the fuel a little hotter. And then because the fuel is a little hotter, more atoms will fuse and they'll deposit their energy, and then it'll get a little hotter. Eventually, you'll have more energy from fusion reactions than you do from the laser that was required to compress the capsule. And that's really what we did.
So, and that's the aha moment, right?
That's the aha moment.
It doesn't matter how much it costs in terms of energy, dollars, whatever. If it makes more than it costs, then you've got a net positive, and that's when you're creating some true sustainable change.
Right. So for this first step, we were able to create more fusion energy out, a little more than 3 million joules of fusion energy for 2 million joules of laser energy in. So that's target gain of 1.5.
They channel an astonishing amount of energy into the capsule, far surpassing the entire U.S. power grid. To put this into perspective, NIF delivers 500 trillion watts of peak power, over 1,000 times the total power consumed by the United States at any moment.
Now, there is one thing to remember. So we created target gain. It still takes energy to run the laser. So in order for us to charge up all those flash lamps that pump the laser, it takes about 330 million joules of energy off the grid, and we store it in big capacitors and then discharge it into the laser when we need it. So we're still not producing net energy gain. So our wall plug efficiency is very low.
What was accomplished was and has been compared to the Wright brothers flying for the first time. Wasn't the prettiest plane, didn't make any transatlantic crossings, but it worked. Yeah. That was in 2022. How much has progressed since 2022? Has this refined? Has the plane gotten prettier? Is it flying further? Are we doing better?
It's definitely flying further. Our most recent ignition repeat showed a gain of more than 2 for the first time. So we've gotten over 5 megajoules of yield.
Okay.
And that
you had 3 megajoules before, yeah?
Okay. Right. And my hope is that we'll demonstrate even higher yields this year. And the goal for this first phase is to get to the point where we can reliably ignite capsules and we can have enough gain that we can begin to change the parameters and understand what impact they have. So can we try a different capsule material or a different laser pulse shape or a different way to make the X-ray oven? It's harder to survey that space until you get enough gain that it doesn't just turn off when you change something. So right now we're doing experiments routinely. Many of them don't ignite because we're changing parameters and we're on the part of the physics curve where the gain goes basically straight up and down. So you might get 10 megajoules or you might get one. We don't know. Sure.
And I think what's a really important distinction here, fusion itself is not hard. In 2018, I hope you employ this kid or you already have a recruiting offer out to him like a professional athlete. But 12-year-old Jackson Oswalt achieved nuclear fusion in his bedroom, his playroom in Memphis, Tennessee. That's crazy. Yeah. By the way, I mean, yeah, it might not be that big of a deal to this, but just hearing that is just who does that? My kids were burning ants with magnifying glasses. That's what I was doing. My kids, I was doing that. So the fusion part isn't hard. It's the sustaining part, and it's the how do you ignite it and have it keep sustaining over and over and over and over and over again. You just said it. There's times that you can do it, and ba-da, we got 10 megajoules, and there's times where it sounds like a video game fail, right?
So the first thing is, yes, it is easy to make fusions. And there are lots of different techniques to do that. You can do that with a very small tabletop laser and a little bit of a little gas jet to make puffs of gas to focus your laser into. Making a lot of fusion neutrons is hard. You need these big facilities. There's another approach to fusion for energy applications, which is called magnetic confinement fusion. They use a different concept. That's where you build a large device. Typically, they're tokamaks, so it's a big torus, very big. I'm doing this with my hands. It's not this size. It's as big as a house. Torus, you put a very low-density plasma in it, and you squeeze it with a magnetic field, and you try to hold it for a long time. So they have never achieved gain greater than one with magnetic fusion.
Okay.
So... and they've been at it as long as we have with the lasers.
Who's they?
Those people. There are many. Actually, some of those people are the
people. What do you mean, those people?
I'm just kidding. We do magnetic fusion too.
I'm just seeing this West Side Story of the rivalry between magnetic fusion and laser fusion.
The Sharks and the Jets?
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
So we have teams that work on magnetic fusion. The big magnetic fusion project in the world right now is called ITER, which is...
Can you spell that?
ITER.
Okay.
It's being built in the south of France, in Cadarache. It's an international project. Many countries are participating, trying to build a reactor that they believe will achieve gain. Now, ITER's taken a very long time to build and probably won't have... deuterium tritium plasmas until the mid-2030s. The other facilities, major facilities, you probably have heard about the JET facility in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Their big tokamak holds the record for the most fusion yield, but again, no gain, but the most fusion neutrons.
Let us quickly recap the difference between these two types of fusion. In magnetic fusion, they use strong magnets to trap and squeeze a hot gas called plasma without letting it touch the sides of its container. Imagine holding a water balloon in the air only using invisible magnets so it floats without breaking. In laser fusion, they shoot a bunch of powerful lasers in a tiny ball of fuel from all directions. It explodes in the middle, releasing energy.
When we talk about self-sustaining fusion now, and the advancements that you've made with this Wright Brothers flight in 2022, are we still 30 years away from creating the self-sustaining fusion energy source? Or do you feel that the private sector is going to accelerate this to be able to take those numbers down to where in our lifetime we'll be able to see an energy grid that is self-sustaining?
I sure hope so. So to first order... there's two things that are going to be important. The private sector can't do this on their own because there are things they need that the big particularly the national labs, have the infrastructure to tackle that the average private company, no matter how well funded, just does not. So there's a lot of common cause between the public and private sector. And if you believe that, then the answer is time is money. So to the extent that there is not sufficient public sector investment in solving those specific problems, the timescale gets longer. And for inertial fusion, because it took us so long to get to this Wright Brothers moment, there wasn't really an inertial fusion energy program at all before that. I mean, there were people who did not believe that it was possible for us to achieve ignition with the National Ignition Facility. They thought we needed a laser that was somewhere between 5 and 10 times bigger. So in that environment, it's probably reasonable to wait, but now we really need to move. Mm-hmm. And so the programs at the Department of Energy in particular are beginning to take shape, but it's still early days. So it could be 20 years with the right kind of focused investment and accelerated program to solve these technological challenges and work in partnership with these companies to make their ideas reality. Or it could be 30 years or more if we don't move out quickly enough to solve some of these bigger, more systemic needs that the whole community would benefit from.
Is there a reason why there wouldn't be more of a, I'm not going to say an open source, but more of a Creative Commons outlook towards the what you've developed, since it's taxpayers' money and you've got taxpayers that are trying to start industries?
Yes and no. The technology we develop is available to license, and that's openly available to many companies. But this is a little bit different. It really is more what you described. And I like the use of the phrase Creative Commons. What I'm hoping we can achieve is some kind of multilateral partnership where we can very rapidly advance the physics of inertial confinement fusion for energy applications, the targets and the driver technologies, and a broad range of companies can all learn from that at the same time and help guide that. So if they want us to do special work, they have to pay for that because the taxpayers mm-hmm. aren't paying for them. You know, we're not paying for your company's technology. You have to pay us for access to our technology. So
sure.
I'm just trying to get out of this model of one company comes and they give us a little bit of money and we do one experiment and then they go away. And then another company comes, we need another cumbersome agreement, we do one experiment and then they go away. We need a way to create a set of common goals and objectives, a common program that could benefit many, because we have a real opportunity to lift a new industry for the U.S., which is, how often does that happen? So very excited to find new ways to work with the private sector. DOE is experimenting with some things. They created some new programs to really aid these companies to get rolling. And what we haven't had yet is a good mechanism for the lab to have more flexibility to participate with these companies.
Do you see yourself as what Bell Labs was to being this reservoir of brilliance that spun off, you know, incredible companies? Do you see yourself as kind of a similar entity in history?
I do. I think particularly as the great industrial labs the dearly departed great industrial labs mostly have changed in fundamental ways. The national labs really are the successors to that legacy. We do that. We have an incredible culture of what I call serial entrepreneurship inside our technical ranks. People who have just revolutionized field after field because they're full of creative ideas and they love to make things happen and then they're onto the next problem. But we also serve a second purpose, and that's really being large-scale entities that can be honest arbiters of technical issues, complicated technical issues, and can really represent the public interest on complex issues. And I think that's growing more important with time as well. Our motivation is to serve the nation.
Amazing. Kim, really, I really appreciate it. And I'm not kidding. Thank you so much for joining us. We've been very excited about this interview. congratulations for paving the way. What you're doing, I know for a fact that there are girls and women around the world who have decided to go and pursue their careers in science because of you. So thank you for the role that you play in science.
Oh, you're very kind. I feel very honored to have this opportunity.
And that wraps up another episode of the podcast where we talk to some of the most fascinating people transforming the impossible into the not impossible. A big thank you to Dr. Kim for an absolutely nuclear conversation about achieving the first net positive fusion reaction, a milestone that proves that limitless clean energy isn't just a dream, it's a real possibility. It's conversations like these that remind us that breakthroughs once dismissed as science fiction can become reality. Don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast platforms, and remember, change is hard, but making the world a better place, it's not impossible.